This is edition number 2018 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 22nd of May, 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 21st of May, 2026. My name is Sue Jay, and my fellow readers are
Beverly Hopkins,
Tony Escrit,
and Ruth Harrison.
On the notice board today, the Mardler Annual General Meeting will be held on Saturday, the 6th of June, in the Methodist Hall, 26 White Hart Street, Aylsham, NR11 6HG. Tea, coffee and biscuits will be served from 10 a.m, with the meeting starting at 10:30. All Mardler listeners and volunteers are welcome. This week, the sun will rise around 4:45 and will set at about 9 o'clock.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes A Gorgeous Garden Haven, Sir David Attenborough's Most Memorable Quotes, My Music for May, and BAFTA Award for Dame Mary Berry.
But we begin with the main news items, which include temperatures rise over hot tub, bus shelter transformed, car park digital revolution, Norfolk County Children's Services, Norfolk Police Officer, Generation Z Property Ladder, Heritage Railway, and Challenge to Block Local Government Reform. Let's start with those lead stories.
Temperatures are rising in a North Norfolk village over a luxury air of B&B's hot tub. Locals in Thorpe Market had complained to North Norfolk District Council about shouting and screaming and loud music being played into the early hours from the greenhouse. The property has been labelled the Party House, and neighbours say they were frequently kept awake into the early hours by visitors enjoying noisy hijinks in the greenhouse's hot tub. Villagers' anger finally bubbled over when the venue's owners put in a retrospective planning bid to keep it running as a holiday let. The flurry of objections led to the council pulling the plug on the venue and turning down the application. But in a fresh move, the property's owners have now appealed against the decision and have agreed to remove the hot tub in an effort to ease tensions with the neighbours.
A bus shelter has been transformed into a life-saving hub in the North Norfolk village of Suffield. Located in Suffield Green, the shelter now features an off-grid emergency defibrillator station, the first to convert an existing bus shelter into an off-grid life-saving hub. The project was led by Suffield Parish Council using a bespoke solar and wind-powered cabinet designed by Turtle Medical. Karen Harris, a councillor at Suffield Parish Council, said, "Everyone at Turtle is terrific, so helpful and nice. Mike designed the whole thing from photos and measurements, then came to install it." The council had previously explored powering a defibrillator cabinet from an old telephone box site, but when that proved unfeasible, they discovered Turtle Medical's standalone, renewably powered unit. Inspired by a similar installation in Creswell, Staffordshire, Councillor Harris contacted Turtle to see if the brick bus shelter in Suffield Green could be adapted to house the equipment. Councillor Harris said, "We do have an ageing population in Suffield Parish, so everybody is very pleased. This brings peace of mind to many people. If you don't live in a small village, it's something you might not think about, but there are a lot of places with no village hall or pub or even church building to utilise power. The shelter is equipped with two solar panels and a wind turbine to power the heated cabinet, ensuring the defibrillator is always ready for use. In addition to the defibrillator, the cabinet also includes an emergency bleed control kit. The defibrillator has been registered with the circuit and the bleed kit on Bleed Map." Councillor Harris said, "There must be many villages like ours in Norfolk alone, so I hope more people see this innovation and consider it for their communities. The parish council now plans to organise a demonstration of the defibrillator and CPR for residents so they feel more confident in an emergency.
North Norfolk District Council has unveiled its plans to roll out touchscreens in some of its car parks across the district to provide information and guidance for visitors. So far, the council has sought advertisement consent for the Meadow Car Park in Cromer, Beach Road in Munsley, Paul's Lane in Overstrand and Freeman Street in Wells. In the plans, it says the digital format enables real-time updates, including public transport timetables, environmental awareness campaigns, and walking and cycling routes. A spokesman for the council said, "We are working with a number of partners on the rollout of these information points at various locations. Applications for the first site's advertisement consent have been submitted. We plan to roll out further sites in due course." These screens will provide local information and guidance and engaging content, which we hope will enhance the experience of our visitors. The screens, which are proposed to be 55 inches, would replace the need for traditional tourist information centres, the council says. This is not the only change North Norfolk car parks have seen this year. The council raised fees for visitors using coastal and resort car parks rise by 3.8% from April onwards in both towns and smaller villages by the sea. This included a 10p per hour increase on last year's charges in coastal car parks, with a 5p increase on the 30-minute parking and a 5p an hour increase on the resort car park tariff. A public consultation on the changes was held this year, which saw 119 responses and several concerns about the impact the new charges would have on tourism and local businesses. A report said that some were concerned that the higher charges would discourage visitors, shorten stays, and reduce footfall. However, the council agreed to the changes at a meeting in February.
Inspectors have given their verdict on the standard of services Norfolk County Council provides to its most vulnerable children and have rated it outstanding in all areas. It marks a massive turnaround in the County Hall department in just over a decade, with the department going from inadequate to the most top ratings possible. Inspectors from Ofsted, Office for Standards in Education, Children's Services and Skills, visited the council in February to scrutinise areas such as the welfare of children in care, fostering, adoption and child protection. In all five areas inspected, the impact of leaders on social work practice with children and families, the experiences and progress of children who need help and protection, the experiences and progress of children in care, the experiences and progress of care leaders, and overall effectiveness, an outstanding rating was given. Inspectors praised the council's child-centred approach, relationships between social workers and children and young people, and the inspirational, strategic, and operational leadership. They said, "Children in Norfolk received consistently strong services that impact positively on their and their families' lives." Since the previous inspection in November 2022, when the department was rated as good, leaders have relentlessly continued to strengthen and enhance practice for children, young people and their families. It is in striking contrast to inspections in 2013 and 2015, when the department was rated inadequate. Sarah Tuff, Executive Director of Children's Services, appointed in 2017, said, "This report is the culmination of many years of incredible hard work from everyone across Children's Services, and I want to thank staff from across the service for all they're doing to help Norfolk's children to flourish. I'm particularly pleased the inspectors highlighted the strong relationships practitioners have with children and young people and the ambition we have for both children in our care and for the service as a whole. Staff across the department change children's lives every day, and they deserve this recognition. This has been a huge transformation and has taken commitment from across the council. We've been able to invest in services that change children's lives, supporting families earlier, and wrapping support around young people so that they can thrive.
A Norfolk police officer remains on duty despite appearing in court accused of assault. PC Demi Colk denied two counts of assault by beating against the same male complainant when she appeared at Ipswich Magistrates Court. The alleged incidents, said to have taken place in Norwich between April the 1st and April the 8th, 2024, are believed to not have occurred while on duty or to be related to police work. The 28-year-old officer, based in North Walsham, has not been suspended despite the charges. A spokeswoman for Norfolk Constabulary said she remained at work on restricted duties. Colk, who gave an address at Possick near Norwich, will next appear at Chelmsford Magistrates Court on May the 15th for a case management hearing. Police officers in the UK are not always suspended automatically when they are charged with a criminal offence. Guidance from the College of Policing states officers can be suspended or placed on restricted duties, though there has been a toughening of rules for certain serious criminal offences, following high-profile cases such as the Sarah Everard murder.
It's not easy to get on the property ladder, but some Gen Zs in Norfolk are bucking the trend and buying earlier than elsewhere. New research by Lloyds has found that North Norfolk is among the areas with the youngest age of first-time buyers in the UK. The average age of a first-time buyer in the area is 28.4 years old, compared to the national average of 32. The Ribble Valley in Lancashire recorded the youngest average age at just 27. The study found the average first-time buyer in North Norfolk paid £242,318 for their home. In nearby Mid-Suffolk, where the average first-time buyer age is 28.7, the figure rises to £289,372. In contrast, East Ayrshire in Scotland was identified as the least expensive location for first-time buyers, with an average price of £147,353. Great Yarmouth was highlighted as one of the most affordable places to buy, with the average first-time buyer paying £236,447 for their home. Amanda Bryden, head of mortgages at Lloyds, said, "Our research shows there are still genuine pockets of value for first-time buyers, particularly for those with an open mind who are willing to be flexible on location and property type. With ongoing cost of living pressures and wider economic uncertainty, it's completely understandable that some people are feeling cautious. But there are opportunities out there, and for many buyers, that flexibility can make a real difference." Ms. Bryden advised first-time buyers to research the home buying process, speak with a mortgage professional early, and explore available support options. Last week, Lloyds announced it is launching a new low-deposit mortgage today that could help first-time buyers get on the property ladder with a deposit as low as £5,000.
A heritage railway has announced a new opportunity to ride in a 129-year-old railway carriage used by royals. The Great Eastern Railway No. 37 will feature in the North Norfolk Railway's vintage train set during the late May bank holiday, running from May the 23rd to May the 25th. Built in 1897, the carriage was saved and restored by the enthusiast Stephen Middleton, and in recent years has run as part of his stately trains operation. Originally built at Stratford as a third-class family saloon, the coach is believed to have later been converted for royal use by Princess Alice, Queen Victoria's granddaughter. Graham Hukins, general manager at North Norfolk Railway, said, "We are delighted to be welcoming a new coach to the railway and would like to thank Stephen Middleton and Stately Trains for allowing this Great Eastern coach to return to East Anglia. Our vintage train is incredibly popular, but as the carriages are over 100 years old and wooden-bodied, we need to take special care of them so they only run on a limited number of days each season. This addition to the vintage train will allow more of our visitors to experience train travel from around 150 years ago. Visitors during the bank holiday weekend will also enjoy unlimited travel behind two other historic steam locomotives. Younger passengers can take part in the newly introduced interactive Spotter's Trail, while history enthusiasts can explore the recently created Heritage Trail at Weybourne Station. The line's steam celebration continues through the May half term, and at least two steam trains running daily. From May the 26th to May the 29th, Holt Station will host the Mad Science Team with science shows and hands-on activities for ticket holders. The Reedham Junction signal box will also open, giving visitors the chance to experience the workings of a traditional signalman.
Rupert Lowe and his Great Yarmouth First councillors will back Reform UK's legal challenge to block government plans to scrap and replace all of Norfolk's councils. In a move which could prove significant given the political makeup at Norfolk County Council, Restore Britain MP Mr. Lowe said the nine-strong Great Yarmouth First group would back the prospective Reform UK administration's challenge. Reform UK, which has 40 councillors at County Hall, three shy of a majority, looks likely to run the authority as a minority administration when the authority elects a new leader on 28th May. That would leave it relying on votes from other parties to enact major policies, and Great Yarmouth First's support to fight local government organisation could prove crucial. Reform UK group leader David Bick announced on Friday, May 15th, his party would take legal action to block proposals to get rid of the current eight Norfolk councils, including Norfolk County Council. The Labour government intends to replace them with three new unitary authorities: Greater Norwich City Council, East Norfolk Council, and West Norfolk Council. Mr. Bick said the party could not stand idly by and watch the government dismember our county. Mr. Bick acknowledged the legal challenge would come at a cost to taxpayers, but said challenging it would be far cheaper than implementing it. And Great Yarmouth MP Rupert Lowe, leader of Restore Britain, of which the Great Yarmouth First councillors are a local arm, agreed. He said, "Our county councillors will oppose it alongside Reform. We fully back the legal challenge and will continue to fight to keep decisions about Norfolk in the hands of local people." John Whedon, leader of the Great Yarmouth First councillors, said, "The people of Norfolk do not want this pointless reorganisation. This legal action is not just about saving tens of millions of pounds. It's about defending the right of local people to run their own affairs." But Kay Mason-Billig, former Conservative leader of the council, said her administration had already started the process to challenge the government. She said, "The decision of the government on local government reorganisation seems irrational, and that needs to be tested. So the Conservative administration at Norfolk County Council had written to the government asking for the reasoning behind the decision. We also put in freedom of information requests and had consulted a King's Counsel to look at options for a possible legal challenge. We're awaiting that advice before deciding, but any challenge has to have a firm legal footing or it's a waste of taxpayer money." Mrs. Mason-Billig, whose Conservative group was whittled down from 50 to 8 at last week's elections, added, "Mr. Bick is just a Johnny-come-lately riding on our coattails. Next thing he'll be telling you is that Reform invented the wheel." The local government reorganisation decision looks to be irrational and based on a political decision. If it is, we should all be opposing it. Under the previous Conservative administration, County Hall had proposed one unitary council and South Norfolk Council wanted two. But the government decided to go with three, as proposed by the other councils: Norwich, Great Yarmouth, West Norfolk, North Norfolk, Breckland and Broadland. Alistair Beales, independent leader of West Norfolk Borough Council, said the challenge was no surprise. He added, "We believe it is important that councils continue to work constructively together in the interests of residents across the county. We believe it's possible to both challenge aspects of the current process while continuing to engage pragmatically and responsibly with partners and government."
Our next few news stories include traveller family battle, offshore wind farm, drone factory break-in and bus service improvements.
A traveller family has resumed their battle to stay on land they bought in a village in the Norfolk Broads. The family, which includes Tom Harbour, his partner Shannon Lee and their children, have been living in a caravan and portable building at Malthouse Corner in Catfield near Stalham after purchasing the land at auction in July 2022. Their retrospective application to change the use of the land to a gypsy stroke traveller pitch was rejected by North Norfolk District Council in 2024, then dismissed on appeal last year when the family was ordered to remove their home from the site by June this year. Ahead of that deadline and still living on the plot, Mr. Harbour has lodged a fresh application with planners, once again asking to change the use of the land. Papers supporting his bid claim that he has addressed the principal reason for the planning inspectorate's refusal of his appeal, which was his inability at that time to demonstrate compliance with nutrient neutrality requirements. Nutrient neutrality requires new housing and overnight accommodation to avoid increasing phosphorus and nitrogen levels in protected areas like the Norfolk Broads. Mitigation is achieved through various measures, including the purchase of Norfolk Environmental Credits. A design and access statement submitted with the new application states that nutrient neutrality credits in the River Thurne catchment are now available. The applicant is therefore in a position to secure appropriate mitigation to address nutrient impacts arising from the development, it adds. Mr. Harbour has previously said that living on the site has allowed their children to receive a proper education after years of homelessness and uncertainty. The family had been facing an enforcement notice issued by the North Norfolk District Council ordering them to remove their home from the site, but a council spokesperson has confirmed the order has been suspended. The council will not pursue further enforcement action until a final determination has been made regarding the fresh planning application, they added.
The first foundations of what will be the world's largest offshore wind farm off the North Norfolk coast have been installed. The latest phase of construction for Orsted Hornsea 3 has seen the first of 197 XXL monopiles, the foundations of wind turbines, securely piled into the seabed. They are being installed by fellow Danish company Cadeler, one of the world's leading offshore wind farm installation companies, which has a UK office at Norwich's St Andrews Business Park. It follows the successful installation of the wind farm's first offshore converter station, which towers 70 metres above sea level, taller than the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and its first offshore export cable arriving onshore at Weybourne. Once complete, Orsted's £8.5 billion Hornsea 3 wind farm will power more than 3.3 million UK homes. The XXL monopiles are the largest used by Ørsted on any of its European wind farms to date, with each being topped by a 15 megawatt turbine. Installation of the remaining 196 monopiles, each weighing an average of 1,670 tonnes and measuring 90 metres in length, will continue over the course of this year and into 2027. A team of more than 200 experts from Ørsted and its contractors, Cadeler and Menck, are working to install the monopiles with the Hornsea Zone, located 70 miles, that's 120 kilometres, off the coast of Norfolk. Luke Bridgman, Managing Director of Hornsea 3 at Ørsted, said, "The installation of Hornsea 3's first monopile is a proud moment for us and is down to the expertise and hard work of our dedicated team. Each monopile is the culmination of incredible feats of engineering, skill and experience, and having the first of 197 monopiles safely installed is a landmark moment." Bradley Scott, Project Director at Cadeler, added, "This milestone is not just about the first structure in the ground. It represents an important step as we continue expanding into full-scope foundation, transport and installation. Delivering projects at this scale requires close collaboration, detailed planning and strong execution across every phase of the operation."
A man from Norfolk is expected to deny wrongdoing after allegedly breaking into a drone factory owned by Israel-based defence company Elbit Systems UK. Three men and three women allegedly used a van to smash into the subsidiary firm UAV Tactical Systems in Braunston near Leicester early on April the 24th. Video shared online after the incident appeared to show a person kicking in parts of a ceiling splattered with red paint. Following the incident, an investigation was launched by Counter-Terrorism Policing East Midlands with the support of Leicestershire Police. The six defendants were charged with burglary with intent to commit damage and causing criminal damage over £5,000. Prosecutor Ben Lloyd told the Old Bailey, "The charges relate to April the 24th this year, in the early hours of that morning, when the six defendants forced entry to UAV Tactical Systems premises in Leicester. That company is a subsidiary of Elbit Systems UK, and it is understood that the target for the attack was selected due to its perceived links to Elbit Systems UK and supply of arms and component parts used by Israel in attacks on Palestine." Mr. Lloyd said a vehicle and power tools used in the alleged break-in caused significant damage to the exterior of the factory, with further damage caused by the spraying of red paint and smashing through ceiling tiles. The video posted on social media afterwards claimed a group called People Against Genocide was responsible for the damage, the court heard. Mrs. Justice Chima Grubb set a plea hearing for August the 7th and a provisional trial from May the 17th next year at Leicester Crown Court. The defendants indicated that they would plead not guilty to the charges against them, which include Peter Jones, 41, of Alderfen Way in Houghton.
Fresh details have been revealed over a host of improvements set to be made to a North Norfolk bus service. Sanders coaches have unveiled several changes for the number 9 service, which goes between Sheringham, Fakenham, Wells, Holt and Milton Constable. The improvements include a new 7:15 a.m. service from Fakenham to Sheringham, and services doubling in frequency to run hourly between Monday and Fridays. It'll also include extra buses running on Saturdays, earlier journeys from Sheringham into Fakenham, and improved buses to get students to and from Fakenham Academy and Reefham College. The family-run coach company has also confirmed that the fare will remain capped at £3, and 15% of weekly bus tickets will be funded by Norfolk County Council. It comes after the business also announced more evening 55B buses between Norwich, Spixworth and North Walsham, and new evening CH2 buses between Cromer, Munsley and North Walsham. The changes are being made in particular to meet the changing travel needs of local young people following the announcement that Sheringham Sixth Form will stop its A-level provision at the end of the academic year. Synergy Multi-Academy Trust, which runs the school, announced the decision at the beginning of the year and said the changes are necessary due to falling pupil numbers. However, councillors feared it would put up huge barriers for children across the area. The improvements to the bus services will come into effect on 24th of May, and the new timetables are available to view online. A statement from Sanders said, "From Sunday 24th May 2026, we're bringing you another round of timetable improvements to local bus services in North Norfolk. These improvements are being made to act on customer feedback and meet changes in travel needs in our area, in particular catering for the changing needs of students affected by the closure of Sheringham Sixth Form."
Hopes have been raised that a closed health centre could be reopened after NHS buses met campaigners fighting for it to be brought back into use. Benjamin Court in Cromer has stood empty for nearly 3 years after it was shut without public consultation in June 2023. The site had provided short-term care beds for patients well enough to leave hospital but not ready to return home. It was due to be sold off, but campaigners from the Save Benjamin Court campaign have been pushing for it to be brought back into use. They recently met bosses from the newly formed Norfolk and Suffolk Integrated Care Board, ICB, to discuss the building's future. And campaigners said the talks had been positive, given the ICB wants to create more neighbourhood health services. At a recent meeting, campaigners said they had had positive talks with the newly formed Norfolk and Suffolk Integrated Care Board, which indicated it wanted to create more neighbourhood health services in the area. Martin Booth, one of the Benjamin Court campaigners, said he hoped that could lead to the buildings being put back into use. He said, "This is a step forward from how things were before. They want to work with us to develop neighbourhood healthcare options. Delayed discharges from hospital are as bad as ever. We are pleased with the progress, but as far as we are concerned, we want to see it opened as soon as possible." An ICB spokesman said, "We have agreed to meet with the group again in the summer to explore service provision in the area and to work with partner organisations so local people have access to a broad range of services they need. We are committed to working with the group and are grateful to them for the feedback they have shared with us as part of their most recent survey."
The first phase of new housing development on the edge of a Norfolk town is set to open to the public. Hopkins Homes will welcome visitors to the Tanners Quarter in North Walsham this weekend, marking the launch of the first 91 houses as part of a wider 343-home scheme. Located near North Walsham Garden Centre, the development offers a mix of 2, 3 and 4 bedroom homes and includes public open spaces, a community orchard, allotments and a natural play area. The site was unveiled to local leaders including councillors Lucy Shires and Mal Gray and Deputy Mayor Helen Richardson, who officially opened the show homes at an exclusive first look event last weekend. Ben Fusedale, Managing Director of the Untypical Groups Anglia region, said, "It was a genuine pleasure to welcome local representatives, partners and community figures to the Tanners Quarter for this special preview event. This development has shaped with community and longevity in mind, and it's been incredibly rewarding to see that vision come to life. Designed to complement the character of North Walsham, the homes combine traditional architectural features with modern energy-efficient design. The development is expected to contribute more than £900,000 towards areas including education, healthcare, highways, libraries, policing and habitat mitigation in the local area. Mr. Fewsdale said, "North Walsham is a town with real character, and from the very beginning our ambition has been to create a place that reflects and respects that. Seeing the show homes open their doors for the first time and watching people experience the spaces we've worked so hard to create is a proud moment for everyone involved. Each property meets accessibility standards and includes air source heat pumps, high performance insulation and either an A or B EPC rating. Green corridors will promote walking and cycling within the development."
The richest people in East Anglia have been revealed. The Sunday Times Rich List is an annual ranking of the 350 wealthiest people across the country. This year's edition shows that most of the wealthiest people in East Anglia live outside Norfolk. With an estimated net worth of £12.6 billion, heiress Kirsten Rousing is the richest person in the region. Couple Mark and Lindy O'Hare came in second place for East Anglia, with an estimated wealth of £1.836 billion amassed from their data analytics business. In third place for the region is Peter Harris and his family. They have an estimated £1.787 billion to their name, coming from his career as a leisure entrepreneur. Developer John Hunt came in fourth place, with an estimated £1.447 billion, while new entrant Paul Hamilton ranked fifth with £1.081 billion. Sports promoters Barry and Eddie Hearn re-entered the chart at the sixth richest in the region with £1.035 billion. Developers Luke and Brian Cummer came seventh with £946 million, and the Duke of Bedford placed eighth with £882 million. Horse trainer Patricia Thompson and her family were the ninth richest in East Anglia with a net worth of £902 million, up from £874 million in 2025. And house builder Andy Hill and family came 10th with £845 million, up from £724 million last year. Ed Sheeran is the wealthiest under 40 in East Anglia with £410 million, followed by Anthony Joshua with £240 million. Robert Watts, compiler of the Sunday Times Rich List, said, "For nearly 40 years, the Sunday Times Rich List has analysed the fortunes of Britain's most affluent people. We believe understanding where wealth lies and where it's being accumulated is a vital part of a functioning democracy. This year's edition shines a light on fortunes made from artificial intelligence, driverless cars, and cryptocurrencies, as well as baby milk, makeup, hoodies, and other everyday items. We know that many of our readers find those rags-to-riches stories of entrepreneurs who started out with little more than a laptop and an idea particularly inspiring."
A North Norfolk estate has demonstrated the pivotal importances of its long-term water strategy as parched farms across the region grapple with the dry spring weather. About 100 farmers and industry professionals joined a tour of the study estate near Holt, organised for members of Norfolk-based agricultural purchasing group, AF. They heard insights into the estate's cropping strategy, its integration of livestock grazing, and its environmental, woodland and deer management activities. But the main topic was the extensive water management strategy, which underpins the farming and environment operations. This includes investing in reservoirs formed by the gravel and sand extraction quarries which helped fund their development. An abstraction licence allows water to be taken from the River Glavon during high flows to be stored and used to irrigate premium food crops in the summer. Charlie McNichol, the third generation of his family to manage the estate, said this approach had put the business in a more resilient position for the future. But he added that the estate had emptied all of its water resources from two reservoirs and two boreholes in two of the last 5 years, proving the continued need to optimise water as concerns grow over stressed crops amid the latest dry spring. It's a silly game, farming, because we're only one big rainfall event away from being unconcerned, he said. If last Saturday night's rainfall was anything like 10 to 12 millimetres, that would probably have bought us another couple of weeks. But we didn't get it, so we're concerned. The longer this dry spell goes on, it's going to be a problem. Looking further forward, are we now in a cycle of dry springs? I grew up with April showers, but our weather stats show that April is often the driest month of the year, not July, and certainly not August. So how do we think about our businesses, our crops, if we're going to get these dry early springs? Do we change our crops, change our rotation? All that has to be under review. Mr. McNichol said the estate had already made cropping decisions aimed at gaining full value for any irrigation used. What we're trying to do is premiumise our products where we can, he said. We're restricted in how far we can push this, as we're still broadacre arable farmers producing largely commodity crops. But if we can find a premium, price or yield, we must grab it. For example, in very dry conditions last year, on a field of light soil, we only achieved 7 tonnes a hectare for feed wheat, which we sold at £165 a tonne. On another field at study, which wasn't quite so light, with 60 millimetres of irrigation, we achieved over 9 tonnes a hectare for seed wheat. That's a 2-tonne response. And we sold it at over £200 a tonne, which more than paid for the irrigation, so the economics of that makes sense. Over 60% of the wheat we're now growing is for seed. It's got a premium. It also moves off farm in September or October rather than May, so you've got your money 6 months earlier. That has value now with higher interest rates. We have a long-term rotation, which is all about the best soil management. However, we're now also trying to react to some pretty difficult gross margins. Study's first reservoir was built in the 1990s, storing 45,000 cubic metres of water to start the family's vegetable business. Another 200,000 cubic metres was added when a second reservoir was finished in 2019, following the extraction of sand and gravel to be sold to the construction industry, a key part of the economic equation for the development. A third reservoir will add another 300,000 cubic metres of water storage when the current quarrying project is completed. Our water strategy was started by my father, the late Ian McNichol, in the 90s, said Mr. McNichol. So we were already trying to diversify away from just combinables and sugar beet and go into premium vegetable crops 30 years ago. What we've done since is accelerate that strategy quite significantly by building bigger reservoirs for our own use, but also selling water to our neighbours. Not everybody can do that, and there are the majority, I suspect, of East Anglian growers who are only combinable and beet producers. And you know, my heart goes out because for the last 2 years, unless you're on really strong ground producing high-yielding cereals, it's got to be tough. Mr. McNichol told visitors at the event that farming was the core operation in a diverse business, which also includes residential and commercial property, community activities, and the Study Lodge gardens. The farm grows arable crops including seed and feed wheat, seed and distilling barley, sugar beet, oilseed rape, peas and AD maize, and works with partner vegetable and potato growers. Study is also home to a premium pig unit and land is let to graziers so Aberdeen Angus cattle and Texel sheep can manage the grassland in the summer and provide muck and graze cover crops in the winter. You are listening to edition number 2018 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday, 22nd of May, 2026. Still to come, there are items about care home awards, artists' open studios, and orchard planting, and of course the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, letters to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
This is a letter from David Thompson of the Broadland Model Railway Club. Since our last missive, we have been quite busy. Broadland was shown at the Norwich Model Railway Club event in Helsdon, as was a club members' layout Rampage, where it won Best in Show. Harrington was shown at the Swaffham Railway Reflections event, and just recently, another club members' layout, Endine, was shown at the Norfolk and Suffolk Narrow Gauge Modellers Open Day in Beccles. We certainly do get about. We have also held our annual general meeting. The entire committee was re-elected. The club finances are in good shape and we have plenty of plans for the future. Now it's all hands to the pumps getting ready for our own model railway show coming up on the late May bank holiday Sunday, May the 24th, at the Poppy Centre in Stalham, with club layouts and guests plus traders stands. Full details are on our website, so please check regularly. We are a very active group and we are very fortunate in having 24/7 access to our club rooms, something few other clubs have. A number of us take advantage of this to work in a group or alone outside our regular sessions on a Tuesday and Friday evenings. It would be entirely possible to have other sessions on other days to cope with the demands, and full members can have keys so they too can gain access at any time. Please do check our website for latest news and contact details if you wish to find out more about us and the opportunities to join us at broadlandmodelrailwayclub.co.uk.
Elizabeth Grint of Wroxham writes, "Last week was Mental Health Awareness Week, a week to consider our own mental health issues and awareness. With all the tribulations and media hype of every event instantly in front of us every day, it's easy to let our minds think the worst of everything. Financial hardships like petrol price increases makes life more difficult for most of us. Thinking of how the extra cost of just travelling to work has got to be found from somewhere. In all this, I hope we can all find time to go for a walk, stop, smell the roses and wisteria blooming now in abundance, take time to breathe deeply of the free, fresh air that is so restoring and healing of our minds. The free endorphins that releases is maybe better than anything and at no cost to anyone except time. Which, even if we have to drag the children for a walk with us, is worth every moment. My great-grandson enjoys his trike ride with me at the weekends. Even better than any fast food, too." David Bill, MBE, President of the Society of Old Pastonians, writes, "Every Trafalgar Day, or as close as possible to that date, the Society of Old Pastonians gather in the Nelson Room at the former Paston School in North Walsham. This is a tradition which dates back to 1912, so it's something of an occasion. We dine in the room, which has one of the finest collection of Nelson memorabilia in the country. Despite the fact that the school is now part of the Sixth Form College, the original buildings and the Nelson Room still survive. This year, it is my privilege to be the current president of the Society, and I would very much like former friends to join the occasion, which this year is being held on Saturday, October the 17th. It is 70 years since I first entered the school, but it has not changed that much over the years, although we all have. Now to this week's obituaries."
Janet Ann Smith Helms, passed away peacefully on the 21st of April 2026, aged 74. A much-loved wife, stepmother, step-grandmother and friend, who will be sadly missed by all who knew her. A private funeral service will be held for family and friends only.
And now some local events. On Tuesday the 26th of May, Wednesday the 27th and Thursday the 28th of May, Beauty and the Beast at 7:30, £20, Disney's family favourite musical at the Pavilion Theatre, Cromer. Details on panda.howell@btinternet.com, 01603 738 356. And on Thursday the 28th of May, Games Through the Ages, a family event at 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock, £3. Can you master games through time? At Lynn Museum, Market Street, King's Lynn. Details lynn.museum@norfolk.gov.uk or 01553 775001.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we learn about the history of A Gorgeous Garden Haven, Sir David Attenborough's most memorable quotes, My Music for May, and BAFTA Award for Dame Mary Berry.
Gorgeous garden haven set within a bustling city. KL Magazine, May 2026. What was once an abandoned chalk quarry has been transformed into a gardener's paradise thanks to a Victorian visionary. But there was a time when the plantation garden's beauty was forgotten. Residents of Norwich City Centre are used to a fast-paced lifestyle. But when the stress of work or endless sounds of traffic get to be too much, they know of a tranquil spot where time seems to stand still. The history of the plantation garden tells of one man's dedication to creating a stunning and serene space for all to cherish. Born in Wisbeach in 1819, Henry Trevor was a man who liked to make things. As a young adult, he travelled to Norwich to become an apprentice in upholstery and cabinet making. Excelling in these crafts, he opened his general furnishing establishment in 1842 on Post Office Street, later Exchange Street, alongside his business partner, Joseph Gray. He eventually moved with his family into a home on Earlham Road, the price of which was rather reasonable as it sat just opposite a large chalk quarry. When the lease on the quarry expired in 1855, it sparked discussions between the trustees of the Preacher's Charity, who had held the land since 1613 and still retain ownership today. They envisaged a residential future for the site, shifting away from its industrial past. Henry Trevor saw his chance to create something spectacular for the city and seized it, promising to build a fine house and an even finer garden within Norwich's deep dell. Plantation House was constructed in 1856 and sat just next to the quarry. Once completed, Henry turned his attention to realising the garden of his dreams. He appointed George Woodhouse as head gardener and built the gardener's cottage for him to live in. It's believed numerous labourers were employed to undertake the monumental task of transforming the quarry into a green oasis. But unfortunately, no records exist to tell us who they were. The deep rocky slopes surrounding the quarry were masked by trees and evergreen shrubs. Serpentine paths ran through the wooded hills to create multiple routes around the garden. A rustic bridge was built across the north end, providing a dramatic vantage point to take in the transformed scenery. Two of the most striking features built for the garden were the Gothic fountain, erected in 1857, and the palm house, completed in 1871. The fountain reflects the Victorian love for blending historical elements with modern architectural styles. Norwich is renowned for being the UK's most intact medieval city, and Henry sought to mirror this medieval aesthetic in his garden while also weaving in popular Gothic revival elements. White bricks from Gunton Brothers Brickworks in Cossey were commissioned to be moulded into Gothic patterns. These bricks were intentionally produced to age gracefully, acquiring a weathered appearance over time. This process has given the fountain's windows a stone-like appearance, bestowing upon them an aura of antiquity that belies their true age. Glass houses were a popular feature in many Victorian gardens after the glass tax was abolished and advancements in manufacturing made the material cheaper to buy. Henry wanted only the best for his plantation garden. A magnificent octagonal palm house was constructed, showing off intricate craftsmanship and housing tropical plants that visitors would have never seen before. Begonias, Nemesia and Verbena, many now be regular additions to our flower beds, but these were intriguing and exciting plants to the Victorians. Henry delighted in sharing his garden with the community. He's been quoted saying, "A selfish life must be a miserable one. The way to be happy is to make others happy." True to his word, by welcoming visitors into his garden, he spread joy among many in Norfolk. Upon Henry's passing in 1897, the estate underwent numerous transitions. The house served various roles, including a doctor's office, a nursing home, and a midwifery training facility. The palm house was sadly demolished in the early 20th century, and as the years progressed, the garden succumbed to neglect and overgrowth. Eventually, it was lost to memory, surrendering to a wild and untamed state. The garden's revival began in the 1980s, when it was miraculously rediscovered, leading to the establishment of the Plantation Garden Preservation Trust. Presented with a mammoth restoration mission, the Trust set out to remove the dense overgrowth of weeds and plants, stabilise the severely deteriorated fountain, and reconstruct the bridge that had collapsed in the 1940s. Nowadays, visitors can bask in the garden's full magnificence. Beautiful flowers arranged in carpet beds take centre stage in the main lawn. An impressive palm tree now towers where the palm house once stood. And the detailed stonework, crafted by the original artisans, encircles the enchanting space. A dedicated team of volunteers worked tirelessly to preserve this hidden gem, relying on donations and raising funds through special events. Upon entering the spectacular garden, the clamour of the city fades into a hushed memory, guiding you through a realm of horticultural splendour, a legacy of a visionary who found joy in sharing his botanical wonders with the people of Norfolk.
Sir David Attenborough has inspired generations to learn more about the natural world, bringing adventure and wonder, dinosaurs and polar bears into the homes of millions of television viewers. The reassuring, hushed and reverential whisper has narrated every journey as he surveys almost every aspect of life on Earth. Here are some of his most memorable quotes. "It seems to me that the natural world is the greatest source of excitement, the greatest source of visual beauty, the greatest source of intellectual interest. It is the greatest source of so much in life that makes life worth living. I just wish the world was twice as big and half of it was still unexplored. The question is, are we happy to suppose that our grandchildren may never be able to see an elephant except in a picture book? It is vital that there is a narrator figure whom people believe. That's why I never do commercials. If I started saying that margarine was the same as motherhood, people would think I was a liar. You know, it's a terrible thing to appear on television because people think you actually know what you're talking about. I don't run a car, have never run a car. I could say that is because I have this extremely tender environmentalist conscience, but the fact is, I hate driving. If I can make programmes when I'm 95, that would be fine, but I would think I'll have had enough by then. You have to steer a course between not appalling people, but at the same time not misleading them. I don't think we're going to become extinct. We're very clever and extremely resourceful, and we will find ways of preserving ourselves, of that I'm sure. But whether our lives will be as rich as they are now is another question. An understanding of the natural world and what's in it is a source of not only a great curiosity, but great fulfilment. Our planet may be home to 30 million different kinds of animals and plants, each individual locked in its own lifelong fight for survival. Everywhere you look, on land or in the ocean, there are extraordinary examples of the lengths living things go to stay alive. Ever since we arrived on this planet as a species, we've cut them down, dug them up, burnt them and poisoned them. Today we're doing so on a greater scale than ever. There are some 4 million different kinds of animals and plants in the world, 4 million different solutions to the problems of staying alive. Reptiles and amphibians are sometimes seen as simple, primitive creatures. That's a long way from the truth. The fact that they are solar powered means that their bodies require only 10% of the energy that mammals of a similar size require. At a time when ourselves are becoming increasingly concerned about the way in which we get our energy from the environment and the wasteful way in which we use it, maybe there are things that we can learn from life in cold blood. 100 years ago, there were 1.5 billion people on Earth. Now over 6 billion crowd our fragile planet. But even so, there are still places barely touched by humanity.
Looking back over past editions of My Music for You, I see that in May of last year, I chose composers born in the month of May. This year, my choices all have May in the title, and I'm going to present them to you in chronological order. They span over 300 years between 1595 and 1902, and therefore cover 4 different musical styles. First up is a madrigal-type part song called a ballet. It's a dance-like song for 4 solo or choral voices, and its title is Now is the Month of Maying by Thomas Morley, 1557 to 1602, who was a composer and singer of the late Renaissance. He was a member of the English madrigal school, which was heavily influenced by Italian music. He lived in London at the same time as Shakespeare and was the most famous composer of secular music in Elizabethan England. He was also active in church music and was a singer, composer and organist at St. Paul's Cathedral. This ballet delights in bawdy double entendre and is apparently about spring dancing, but clearly lovemaking is involved, and references to "Shall we play Barley Break?" is reference to a roll in the hay. For those of a sensitive disposition, we moved swiftly on and spring forward to 1840 and Robert Schumann's best-known song cycle, Dichter Liebe, A Poet's Love. From this cycle, with verses by Heinrich Heine, the very first song picks itself today, In the Beautiful Month of May. It's an example of German Lieder or romantic song, and rather than paraphrase it, here is a quotation from the opening. In beautiful May, when buds sprang, love sprang up in my heart. In beautiful May, when the birds all sang, I told you my desire and longing. I'm sure you get the gist. From Schumann, we navigate 61 years to Edward Elgar in 1901, and a charming piano piece simply called May Song. Described as a salon piece, it was composed at the latter end of the Romantic period and on the cusp of the English art song period. It is suggested that its composition was intended to coincide with the 21st birthday of Elgar's niece, May Grafton, but it was not specifically dedicated to her. Whilst originally written as a piano solo, it has been arranged for various duet and orchestral forces, but it appears to be a song without words. My final selection dates from 1902, just a year after the Elgar, and it is a duet from the English comic opera Merry England by Edward German. The story is of love and rivalries at the court of Queen Elizabeth I, with characters such as the Queen herself, Sir Walter Raleigh, the Earl of Essex, Bessie Throckmorton, and Jill alone. In this song, Jill and Sir Walter sing in duet. It is the merry month of May, the birds do sing a roundelay, and all the world is sunny. I hope that your May measures up to this, and you shall all be in good spirits when we meet again next month.
Mary Berry, Fellowship at the BAFTA Television Awards by Jenny Garnsworthy from the Norfolk Magazine, May 2026. Dame Mary Berry has said it's the icing on the cake to learn she is to be honoured with the BAFTA Fellowship for her exceptional contribution to television. Dame Mary, 91, will be presented with the fellowship at the BAFTA Television Awards. She said she was completely overwhelmed at the news. What an honour for a cook to receive the BAFTA Fellowship, she said. I couldn't believe it, for just doing what I love. BAFTA said the fellowship is their highest accolade bestowed on an individual in recognition of an outstanding and exceptional contribution to film, games, or television. Describing Dame Mary as one of the UK's most beloved broadcasters, it said her career has spanned six decades after she first appeared on TV in the 1970s. It said her role as a judge on the Great British Bake Off was nothing short of transformative. By shifting the genre towards a format rooted in warmth and encouragement, she inspired a national resurgence in home baking and established a new paradigm for competitive programming, one that champions craft and joy, BAFTA added. The BAFTA Television Awards take place at the South Bank Centre's Royal Festival Hall in London on Sunday, May 10th, and will be broadcast on BBC One and BBC iPlayer. Dame Mary said, I couldn't believe it was true. What a huge honour to be presented with the BAFTA Fellowship. For over 50 years, I've enjoyed every moment of teaching my passion on television, and I thank all the generous professionals along the way who've given me guidance and support. I'm still learning. This amazing BAFTA Fellowship is the icing on the cake. The cookery star, who was made a dame in the 2020 birthday honours, said her proudest moment on TV so far was filming with the Prince and Princess of Wales for her Christmas special, A Berry Royal Christmas, in 2019. They put their whole heart into making roulades and achieved great things with a lot of laughter, she said. William sent a special message to mark her 90th birthday in 2025, describing her as a true national treasure in a video aired on the BBC. BAFTA Chief Executive Jane Millichip said, "Dame Mary Berry is a singular talent whose warmth, craft and generosity have helped shape the very best of British television. Mary Berry, for more than 60 years, has informed, inspired and entertained audiences, setting a new benchmark for factual entertainment and proving that expertise and empathy can draw huge audiences in prime time. The BAFTA Fellowship is our highest honour, and we're proud to celebrate Mary's extraordinary legacy at this year's BAFTA Television Awards." Previous recipients of the fellowship include Kirsty Walk, Sir Billy Connolly, Dame Joanna Lumley, and Sir David Attenborough.
To finish off this edition of the magazine, we have an on-the-spot report from our peripatetic volunteer, Beverly Hopkins, where she chats with Pat Precop, chairman of the Aylsham Town Council Chittislow Committee.
Hello, Patrick. Thank you for coming into Mardler headquarters to talk to us about your subject. Over to you.
I'm the chairman of the Chittislow Committee on the Aylsham Town Council. I'm also chairman of Slow Food. You may see a theme coming through here. Slow is the key word, and slow means snails. The snail is our logo. The snail, again, will feature quite a lot in this discussion because we have got lots of things on. At the moment, we just finished celebrating 20 years of Chittislow in Aylsham. I suppose I should really explain what Chittislow is. It's a concept, part of a movement as well, which all started back in 1989 with the Slow Food. Slow Food was formed by a bunch of Italians down in Rome. It was mooted that McDonald's was going to open a restaurant at the foot of the Spanish Steps with a major sort of tourist attraction. And of course, the Italians locally were up in arms about that. And they protested, not with banners or megaphones or anything, but they just went round with bowls of pasta and introduced people to the real food. I say, this is
brilliant.
Yeah. That established the movement in that respect. Chittislow came about two or three years later, following the discipline of the slow food ethics, which is basically eat healthy, shop locally, support your culture, your local culture. Chittislow basically is to do with community, is to do with heritage, culture, and of course, well-being. Now, the well-being thing is where things in town, in Aylsham, start to sort of take shape, and this is why Chittislow is part of Aylsham. Incidentally, Aylsham is the only Chittislow town in England, and it's only one of three in the whole of the UK. The other two are in Wales, in Mold and Llangollen.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it started off very well. I mean, there were about 15 to nearly 20, I think, Chittislow towns in the UK. But for various reasons, mostly to do with finances and council resources and stuff like that, various other councils and towns pulled out of it. It does require attention. You do need to sort of focus on it quite a lot because without that, you tend to forget about it and everybody just walks away and it just closes down. So you'll find that we do a lot of events around the town, either badged as Chittislow or Slow Food. Slow Food is very well known around here for its food festival in October. 3 days, where the first day, the Friday night, is the launch of the three-day event. The high school, Aylsham High School Cooking Department, it's better known as a nutrition and something else department. For
home economics when I was at school.
Yes, well, they are really brilliant. They are an excellent team in that in Aylsham High School. And they teach the pupils all about local food, local produce, how to prepare it, how to cook it.
Fantastic.
And we celebrate that on that Friday night with a dinner at the high school, and it's prepared and cooked and served by the students. It's a magic evening.
Excellent.
So you get the shortest waiters you've ever seen, the 3 foot lads and lasses coming up with big bowls of stuff, you know. But it's well attended, it's very well recognised, and it's a joy to do. The Saturday, the following day, is the market. It's the usual monthly food craft market, but this has got added bonus because it's then flagged as part of the food festival, and we try to do more things in the marketplace than we would do otherwise. At every event, we try to get entertainment in as well, where we can, so that will be an attraction too. And it finishes on the Sunday morning with a brunch in the town hall, where all the members, or those that are able to, prepare breakfast for the town. And we have held about 100 people in the hall there throughout Sunday morning.
So, Patrick, is the meal and the brunch open to all or just Aylsham residents?
Oh, no, it's open to anybody who wants to come along. We've had people from all over the place. From Norwich, would you believe? I mean, they come from far and wide. It's grown. People know more about it now than they did 20 years ago, for sure. And this is really a major hurdle we needed to get over to make people aware of what we're doing in the town. And you'll be surprised how many people are actually aware of it now. We have our own website.
Am I right to say it's www.chisterslow.org?
That's the UK version.
Okay.
We haven't got a local version of that, but we have got our own sort of page on that. And there is a Slow Food website as well, which is slowfoodaylsham.org.uk. And, of course, we have the social media platforms too, where we advertise all our events.
And I've seen around the town myself the Snail Trail emblems. What's that all about?
The Snail Trail has come out of, again, Chiderslow. It's part of the cultural promotion of the town. It's a heritage thing. We have a lot of old buildings in the town, beautiful old Georgian buildings and some older than that. You must remember that Aylsham is a medieval town, and the road system around Aylsham hasn't much changed since the medieval days. And that's mainly because we're about the only town, I think, in Norfolk that hasn't had a major fire to to bring down all the buildings and gave local people an opportunity to reroute the roads. So all the old buildings, many listed, many have got heritage value. We are looking to attract visitors to the town by giving them an opportunity to walk around the town, spot these buildings, and each of the ones that we identify will have a snail, a plaque with a stone snail on it. There are different shapes and sizes, and there'll be others which have got painted on tiles. And that will be, of course, backed up by a map and on the website. And it tells you all about the building, why it's there, and you know, it's an opportunity to go around the town and see it and move around and see the shops as well, of course.
Absolutely. And how long has Aylsham been a Chiderslow town, did you say?
20 years. It became a Chiderslow town after the stock market, in the middle of town, up there where Keys Auctioneers are now. There used to be a big market there, a weekly market, which attracted all the local farmers who put up their animals up there. Everything from pigs to chickens were there, as well as, you know, the vegetables, fruit and vegetables, locally grown. Sadly, when that was forced to close down, there was a big hole in the local economy, and it looked bad for Aylsham. Especially when the supermarkets started to move in, the local traders were a bit concerned about their future, quite rightly. So it was felt that we needed to do something. And when you look around, there is nothing really that tells you how to go about changing the culture of a town or making it, you know, better, other than an economic version of it, which is all a bit dry and dusty. So someone discovered, I think it was Liz Jones, who was in the council at the time now, she's passed away sadly, noticed that this sort of fitted the bill because it energised the local community to shop local, look around their town and enjoy what they've had on the premises there and take part in various events which will bring visitors to the town as well.
Thank you, Patrick, for enlightening us about the Chiderslow. Hope we get lots of visitors come and join in. Thank you.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions. For our final section of news, we are joined by Lorna Townsend.
Hello, everyone. Our last few articles cover a new mayor and deputy, Lord Lieutenant announces deputies, new nursing apprenticeships, and an award-winning actress and artist masterclass.
Three care homes in Norfolk have been named among the best in the region. Coronation House in Thetford, part of Care UK, was ranked one of the top 20 care homes in the East of England by carehome.co.uk at its 2026 Care Home Awards. The home, located in Norwich Road, was praised for its excellent care, modern facilities, and the friendliness of its staff, with the award reflecting consistently high ratings from residents and their families. Teresa Burgess, home manager at Coronation House, said, "We're absolutely thrilled that Coronation House has been recognised as one of the top 20 care homes in the East of England. It's a fantastic achievement and a real reflection of the team's dedication and hard work every single day." Coronation House offers full-time residential, dementia and short-term respite care. The home features a cinema, cafe, hair salon, garden room views, and is designed to support people in living enjoyable and meaningful lives. Engelhard Lodge Care Home in Causton has also taken a spot among the region's best alongside Meadow House Nursing Home in Swaffham.
More than 170 artists will open their studio doors to the public during the North Norfolk Studios Art Event. The free event runs from May 23rd to June 7th and will offer visitors the chance to explore the workspaces of painters, ceramicists, jewellers, photographers and printmakers. Alex Boardman of North Norfolk Studios said, "We're absolutely thrilled that more than 170 artists are opening their studio doors to the public this year. North Norfolk Studios is such a special opportunity for visitors to step behind the scenes, meet the artists in the places where ideas come to life, and experience the extraordinary creativity that exists across North Norfolk." Holly Burton, a potter taking part in the event, said, "Opening the studio to visitors is a lovely way to connect with people and share what I do day to day as a potter. It's also a great opportunity to be part of the wider creative community across North Norfolk. The event is spread across 14 areas of North Norfolk, making it easy for visitors to plan day trips between multiple studios. For more information, visit northnorfolkstudios.co.uk.
North Norfolk has the highest percentage of over 65s in the UK, new research has revealed. Nearly 35% of those living in the district are aged 65 or older, according to the research by Opera Beds, using Office for National Statistics, ONS, data. This figure is far above the national average of 20%. With 36,080 of North Norfolk's 103,217 people in the older age bracket. Barbara Franks, occupational therapist at Opera Beds, said, "As more people live longer, we're seeing a growing need for support that helps people stay independent at home for as long as possible. It's often not one major change that makes the difference, but a series of smaller practical adjustments that support day-to-day comfort and mobility." Coastal and rural areas continue to attract retirees, with high proportions of older people also found in Rother, 32.5%, East Lindsay, 31.5%, and the New Forest, 30.7%. In contrast, the areas with the youngest populations are in London, including Tower Hamlets, where just 5.9% of locals are aged 65 or older.
An orchard has been planted as part of a new housing development. Located in Swanton Overs, the orchard sits beside seven new affordable homes close to completion, built for residents with connections to the village. The project is a collaboration between Swanton Overs Community Land Trust and Broadland Housing Association. Ian Watson, Secretary of the Community Land Trust, said, "We're over the moon with the new housing development, St Edmunds Court. From the outset, the Community Land Trust had a vision to create high quality and beautiful homes for the social purpose of long-term affordable rent." The orchard was planted with apple and hazel trees. Funding for construction had been provided by Broadland Housing, North Norfolk District Council, and Homes England. The apples will be pressed into juice using the village's fruit press. The land for the scheme was donated by the Right Honourable Delaval Astley, who has given land for previous community projects in Swanton Overs.
A community fundraiser has helped support life-saving work in Broadland. The annual plant sale, held on May the 16th at Walcott Village Hall, raised more than £1,200 for Broadland first responders. George Cooper, a trainer with the group, said, "We would like to sincerely thank everyone who either made donations or attended our plant sale, where we had a huge turnout and made over £1,200. The funds will go towards purchasing essential emergency response equipment."
The new mayor and deputy mayor of a Norfolk town have been revealed. It has been announced that Patrick Bennett has been elected as the mayor of Cromer, with Susan Haywood elected as deputy mayor. And as their new council term started, they have vowed to promote what the town has to offer at every opportunity. Mr. Bennett said, "It is a great honour to have been elected mayor of Cromer." He added, "I will endeavour to do my best over the next year to work and promote Cromer at every opportunity." Ms. Haywood said, "I'm looking forward to serving as deputy mayor. As a lifelong resident, I feel a strong affinity for our town and hope to promote Cromer and its events throughout the year."
The Lord Lieutenant of Norfolk has announced three deputy appointments. The Earl of Leicester, Thomas Coke, Claire McIntosh, MBE, and Joe Pearson have been appointed to the Lord Lieutenant's team in Norfolk. Each brings a wealth of experience from across the county. The Earl of Leicester, who manages the Holcombe Estate in North Norfolk and is involved in charities and businesses, said, "I am very much looking forward to my duties back in the county and to meeting and serving the people of Norfolk as an active Deputy Lieutenant." Ms. McIntosh has led the Norfolk Community Foundation for 9 years. During her tenure, the charity invested more than £60 million in community projects. She said, "Norfolk is full of people who see a challenge and choose to do something about it. As a Deputy Lieutenant, I am proud to recognise and shine a light on the volunteers and everyday champions whose work often goes unseen but never goes unfelt." Mr. Pearson said, "It is a considerable honour to be appointed as a Deputy Lieutenant."
New nursing apprenticeships, where people can earn as they learn, are to be opened in Norfolk and Suffolk. Providers of NHS services in the two counties will be able to apply for a share of more than £65 million of government cash to offer the apprenticeships. In 2024-25, 108 nursing degree apprentices were recruited across Norfolk and Suffolk, and the money will enable more to be created. Nurse degree apprentices earn a salary while they train, which health chiefs hope will break down barriers to a career in nursing and enable people to qualify closer to home. Karen Smith, Health Minister, said, "Nurses are the backbone of the NHS, supporting us both physically and emotionally through our most vulnerable moments. But becoming a nurse shouldn't be determined by where you live. That's why we are committed to growing the nursing workforce, especially in the areas of the country with the greatest need. We're unlocking an extra 2,000 additional nursing degree apprenticeships across the country in the areas that need them the most, including Suffolk and Norfolk. applications for funding will be open later this year.
An award-winning actress and artist will be giving an artivism masterclass in Reefham. Rebecca Grant, known for roles in Holby City and Show Trial, will be giving Painting with Purpose masterclasses at No. 21 Gallery. Her workshops will take place on Saturday, June 13th and Sunday, June 14th at 11 o'clock and 2:30 p.m. The sessions incorporate lessons from Ms. Grant's Set Sail collection, adding some colour to more conventional approaches and offering a creative call to action to protect the environment. Her sessions are inspired by the 30 by 30 mission, which pledges to protect 30% of the world's oceans by 2030. The classes will highlight the drama of the sea and the effect of human actions, even using rubbish in the artworks. Ms. Grant said, "This is an invitation to discover yourself as an artist as we journey through the waves to a place of stillness. We are joining a global mission to clean up our act and protect our blue planet." Those interested can book places with sessions costing £50, which includes all premium materials, ocean-themed sips and treats. To book, email Rebecca at rebeccagrant.co.uk or WhatsApp 07762 551 448.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Preston. Editing and producing this issue was Manny Gomez. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!